This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Marxists have been calling on workers of the world to unite for more than a century and a half. But can workers still change the world? A new book says yes. And supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal urge Philadelphia's chief prosecutor not to stand in the way of a possible pathway to freedom.
But first, the Democrats seem certain to step up their investigations of the Trump administration now that they are a majority in the U.S. House. That also likely means more frenzy efforts to link Russia to the Trump presidential campaign. Stephen Cohen is the nation's best-known expert on Russia, having studied that nation's politics in both the Soviet era and after Russia became capitalist. Cohen spoke with Black Agenda Report executive editor Glenn Ford, who remembers the tail end of anti-Russian hysteria during the McCarthy era. But Ford cannot recall anything during the McCarthy era that was as manic, loud, and relentless as today's hysteria against Russia. Professor Cohen agrees.
I, too, remember the end of McCarthyism. I, too, have never seen anything like this. In my new book, War with Russia with a Question Mark, I spend a good deal of time saying just that. I also say, though this may be a bit of an exaggeration, that when I lived in the Soviet Union as a scholar, before Gorbachev came to power and ended the censorship, that would have been in 1985-86, I recall vividly things like this happening in the Soviet Union. That is to say, people falling under suspicion for their, quote, contacts with Russia, for saying things that don't fit the mainstream orthodoxy. So I'm very alarmed by this. And this is quite apart from my dislike for Trump. But one of the points I make in the book is that the peril of this new Cold War is especially great because even when Trump does something sensible on behalf of our national security with Russia, it's called treason. So where does that leave the rest of us who have devoted much of our lives to contacts with Russia, scholarly, political, cultural, and who think that Americans need now, above all, but as we did during the old Cold War, to reach out to all the Russians we know, to bring Russians and Americans together, that's now fallen under suspicion. So it's a dangerous time, and you're absolutely right.
And we hear comments that actually have no place in civil discourse, like a high intelligence official, Clapper, talking about treachery and dishonesty being part of the DNA of the Russian.
And yet, Glenn, when he said that, and it was widely broadcast and printed, I think he said it on a Sunday morning news show, network news show, that Russians were genetically disposed to infiltrate Americans. And John Brennan, the former head of the CIA, said exactly the same thing. There was no protest in the mainstream media, even though it's a form of racism. When you attribute some predisposition to an ethnic group, it's disapproved of normally. If you said it about Jews or black folks or Italians or anybody, there'd be an uproar. But when these two very powerful former heads of our primary intelligence agencies made these remarks about Russia, the Russians passed almost unnoticed, though I treat it in the book. I was shocked that there was no protest. But something's happened here. It's a combination, I think, though I can't fully explain it, of intense dislike for Russia's leader since 2000, Vladimir Putin, and this intense loathing for Trump. And it's created a toxicity that's generated, as you say, a new McCarthyism. They're also doing things now, such as keeping people with dissenting views off radio and television programs where once they were welcomed. So this is a kind of censorship unfolding. And this is aside from the federal prosecutions that are going on. I mean, I personally don't think the Mueller investigation should have ever been established. But what we have at the moment are a bunch of convictions and pleas involving financial corruption that have nothing to do with Russia at all. So it's spreading, as it did under McCarthy. And unless the people who used to fight McCarthyism, that's liberals and progressives, stand up and say stop, I don't see where it's going to end.
You know, that Russian outfit in St. Petersburg that the Mueller folks indicted for meddling of some kind in U.S. politics doesn't look to me like a professional intelligence operation at all. What about you?
Well, let's context this a bit. So people, and I've been widely denounced for protesting this Russiagate stuff, say, well, Cohen, don't you think the Russians meddled in the 2016 presidential elections? And I said, sure they did. And so what? Because the United States has been meddling in Russian politics since the Russian Revolution. People forget we intervened in their civil war. My uncle actually was sent to Russia. I remember him telling me vividly the stories. We virtually got President Yeltsin of Russia reelected in 1996. Everybody knows that story. But we meddle. And they meddle in our elections. The old Communist Party was busy here. And nobody thought much about it. It's just something the two countries have done forever. And the only difference in 2016 was the advent of social media. So people who have looked at this social media and remember that this began as saying the Russians had meddled. Okay. But now they're saying the Russians put Trump in the White House. This is something completely different. But serious people who have studied this, like Aaron Mate of The Nation, don't see that Russian social media added up to much of anything. And you know this guy, Nate Silvers, who's used to work for The Times and is considered the number one electoral pollster in the United States. He's a kind of guru. He said the other day that if there were 100 factors that got Trump elected in 2016, Russian social media wouldn't make the list of 100. And yet, we have the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Yorker magazine, Politico, saying that the Russians put Trump in the White House. So this is unprecedented, I think, in modern American history. Even Nixon, during Watergate, was never accused of being a foreign agent. So I come back to my point. Trump occasionally meets with Putin and he says, you know, we've got to rein in the new nuclear arms race, because it really is a new nuclear arms race. And we got to be careful we don't shoot each other down when we're flying over Syria. It could lead to war. Putin says, right, let's take steps to be careful. Trump comes home and it's called treason. Treason. So the danger is great. What worries me is I think, and I know in some cases, that there are people in Congress and in the mainstream media who agree, but they won't speak out.
For fear of?
I don't know. Is your memory of the late McCarthy period, does it include people whose lives were badly damaged by false accusations and suspicions? I remember a few. I remember my main professor at Columbia. I grew up in Kentucky, but I came to Columbia to get my PhD. A great man, Professor John Hazard, had been called by McCarthy simply because John had been deputy director of Lend-Lease during World War II. You remember Lend-Lease gave the Soviet Army material to fight the Nazis. And we sent them Studebakers and food and Spam. And yet he was called by McCarthy saying he had somehow been a Russian agent. John had a horrible time. He survived it, but it afflicted his life for years to come. So people have a genetic, we Americans have a genetic memory of what happened. Plus, I don't think, leaving aside, I guess, the civil rights struggle and a few other examples, maybe Vietnam, we don't have a very high tradition of civic courage among people in power or positions of authority in this country. We think we're a fiercely independent, free-speaking people, but compared to some nations, not so much, I think.
One of the bizarre aspects of Russiagate is that in their frenzy to charge that the Russians have done such huge harm to fragile U.S. institutions, these folks have actually themselves inflicted harm on the legitimacy of U.S. institutions, including the presidency, but also the U.S. electoral apparatus.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more, and it continues. It's another argument I make in this book, War with Russia, that in this insistence that the Russians, quote, attacked us in 2016, and there was no attack, but the New York Times refers to it as a digital Pearl Harbor. Imagine that, Glenn, a digital Pearl Harbor. I mean, we've been attacked twice, right? Pearl Harbor, I barely remember it. I was barely born. And again, I guess on 9/11, those were real attacks. Nothing like that happened in 2016. But when we say we were attacked by Russia during the election of 2016, imagine how dangerous it is. It implies that we're in a state of war with Russia, the other nuclear superpower, and that we should react accordingly. So you're getting this incredible warmongering that's going on now. And it's alarming that it's come from coming from liberal progressive circles, if not above all, at least equally. And so you have to wonder, those of us who have supported liberal progressive agendas, what this means for those agendas moving ahead. I mean, Nancy Pelosi said the other day, when she had been reelected speaker, that she found Trump's relations with Putin appalling. Now, every American president in my lifetime, since Eisenhower, has been empowered to deal with the Kremlin leader to avoid nuclear war. She is saying Trump should have no relations with the president of Russia. Where does that leave us? By the way, and your point about institutions is a very good one. If the Trump presidency is illegitimate, and that's what, you know, people in the New York Times, for example, I cite the Times only because it's the most influential paper in America, say that Trump's presidency is illegitimate, and the elections that put him there are illegitimate, as you say, it casts suspicion on two pillars of American democracy, the presidency and elections. And it can't stop just with Trump now. I mean, you have losing candidates in local elections literally saying that they lost because of the Russians. I mean, no evidence that the Russians even knew they were candidates, but this is becoming an excuse for losing.
And this is a great irony. Here we have critics, largely from the Democratic Party, who complain about an imperial presidency, a presidency that wages war and moves troops around without consulting Congress, acts as if Congress doesn't exist, an imperial presidency, except when it comes to Russia, and then even the president can do nothing, not even shake a hand.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Exactly. And by the way, for what it's worth, we never ask what is the impact of these Russiagate allegations on Russia itself. A lot. I've been traveling to Russia for decades. I know a lot of Russians. I know Russians who like America, Russians who don't like America. I know Russians who are very happy with Putin. I know Russians who are unhappy with Putin. Russians are a diverse people politically. But the impact of these allegations that are now orthodox in America about Russia's role in our election in 2016 are badly damaging Russian Democrats, because they have argued for a long time that Russia needs to have more of the kind of democracy that America has. But now, if the official story is that Russia subverted our democracy and that Trump is illegitimate and elections are illegitimate, where does that leave those people in Russia who complain about Russian elections? Because people say, well, they do the same thing in America, and you love America, so who cares if Putin's election, re-election to the presidency, wasn't entirely kosher? It's better than it was in America, at least. I mean, I heard this. I was there in November. And I hear this line of discussion. I don't know what people in Europe think of us, but obviously we're becoming the subject of scorn around the world, and these are fictions. I mean, it isn't true.
U.S. media and U.S. politicians routinely call Vladimir Putin a dictator, although they do have elections in Russia. There are different parties. The second biggest party is the Communist Party, and there is polling in Russia, polling done by Russian and Western pollsters, which shows Putin is, well, phenomenally popular.
So we come here to what, for me, a long-time student historian of Russian politics, a complicated question. I begin my new book, War with Russia, with a long essay that's offended a lot of people. It's called Who Putin Is Not. And I look at each of the allegations against Putin, and I say they just aren't true. For example, the allegation that he's ordered the assassination of his political enemies. There's no evidence for that. The question of Putin's authentic popularity in Russia is more complicated. There is no question, anecdotally, and as you say, Russians have become obsessed with polling. They poll all the time, survey opinion. That even though there is growing discontent with Putin in Russia, mainly involving breadbasket issues, inflation, price of consumer goods, and the rest, he has a bedrock, immense popularity, because most people believe he saved Russia when he came to power in 2000, remembering that Russia was in agony for the decade after the end of the Soviet Union. I mean, men were dying on average at 56. People weren't receiving their pensions. Unemployment, disemployment. The economy had become bartering what you had inherited from your parents or your grandparents. Russia was in danger of complete collapse, and above all, the people were in misery. And Putin and the people he brought around him turned that around. He was helped by high oil prices and all the rest, but they didn't steal that money. They put it back into the people. So Russia has begun to prosper under Putin during 20 years, and this is all reflected in statistics and polls. So is Putin a dictator? Well, everything's relative, right, Glenn? I mean, we look around our own lives and we say, how are things? And we say to ourselves, compared to what? Are they better or worse for us or people we care about than they were 20 years ago or 10 years ago? That's the key question in any country. And in Russia, whether we like Putin or not, the Russian people generally are so much better off today after 20 years of Putin's rule than they were before Putin, choose any era you want, that political support means that the numbers he gets when he runs for re-election, close to 65 to 70%, are confirmed by pollsters. That's basically his support. Now, it ebbs and flows. It's been as high as 80. It's dropped down to 60. That's normal. But imagine a politician who's been in office 20 years and retains his bedrock support. That's pretty remarkable. And it has a lot to do with Putin, but a lot to do for Russians with what came before him. So it's contemptuous and it's arrogant for Americans to criticize Putin if the majority of Russian people believe that he's been a kind of savior leader. Now, future historians will judge him for both his pluses and his minuses. And I try to do that in my new book. I say, here, I think, are the pluses. Here are the minuses. But we need some perspective. And all of this demonizing of Putin becomes part of this new Cold War. I mean, I ask myself, and I can't fully explain it, why was it okay for every president of my lifetime since Eisenhower to deal with the leader of the Kremlin, who were Soviet communists? Putin's an anti-communist. He's a capitalist, he says. Deal with them regularly without it being called treason. And yet when an American president talks about arms control or nuclear proliferation or terrorists in Syria, with the Kremlin leader, it's called treason. Something's happened, and it has more to do with us than what's happened in Russia.
And finally, you'd think that the United States would be trying everything in its power to keep Russia and China apart. But it's been clear that U.S. policy has driven these two countries into what is now a strong strategic alliance.
That is certainly true, though I would dissent a bit from the way you set up the question, that we should do everything possible to keep Russia and China apart. My reaction to that is twofold. The old world order, which we sought to dominate, the United States did, and did so successfully for decades, is crumbling before our eyes, whether we look at the East and the rise of China, or we look at the crisis of the European Union and Brexit, or we look at our own country. Trump's, he's not an isolationist, but he's not an interventionist. All these symptoms are signs of a world changing. One of the changes will be, for obvious reasons, that they are neighbors, they are natural trading partners, and they are both threatened by NATO, that Russia and China are going to grow closer and closer together. If this means economic prosperity for both and not a military threat, I'm all for it. I mean, there's no reason why they shouldn't be prospering trade partners. It's a perfect fit. They have what the other needs, goods and markets and investment. But, as you say, our policy is turning them into military strategic allies because we threaten both of them. And that's the mistake. I would like a president that not only blesses Russia, Chinese, economic, cultural affinities, but participates in it and says the United States wants to join you. It'll create jobs in America. But turning Russia and China, as our Pentagon has done in recent years, even beginning under Obama, as our two main enemies, when neither actually threatens us, is a grievous mistake. So I agree with you with the outcome, but I don't think there's any reason why we should worry about Russia and China. You know, it's interesting. Putin wants to create this so-called European-Asian Economic Union, modeled on the European Union. Why is it okay for European countries to gather together to create a vast market, but it's not okay for Russia and China to do the same thing in the East? I mean, if we're all capitalists, to the extent that we profess to be, this is international global capitalism. If what's good for Europe and the United States, why wouldn't it be good for Russia and China, if we care about people?
That was Russian expert Stephen Cohen.
Russia may be capitalist, but socialists around the world still seek the overthrow of the rule of the rich. Michael Yates is an editor with the prestigious left publication Monthly Review. He's a longtime labor educator and a prolific author. Yates' latest book is entitled, Can the Working Class Change the World? Yates think they can and must, but most Americans don't think of themselves as being in the working class, and very few know that 200 million Indian workers recently staged a two-day general strike.
Well, this will be, I think, the 18th general strike in the last 20 years in India. These are the largest general strikes the world has ever seen. They're usually of short duration, and they haven't managed to win great victories yet, but it shows that people can be organized. And not only, I mean, not many workers in India are in unions, for example, yet tens of millions of people without unions, people who are working in the most onerous conditions, millions of women, et cetera, participated in these general strikes. And by the way, it's interesting to note that my book, Can the Working Class Change the World, that you were reading, has just been translated into Hindi. And I got a picture from some comrades in India at this big book fair in Delhi holding my book. And it was the first day of that strike, so it was an auspicious publication date for the book. Well, I think one of the problems here in the United States is really that you're in the center of the beast, so to speak, and yet people are the least informed. And even when you see like progressive politicians and some of the democratic socialists of America, I mean, there's some good things happening. I'm not going to say that there aren't. And there are some people with progressive ideas, there's no question. And yet they seem to take a sort of a nationalistic point of view instead of a global point of view. The problem with that is that capital is global in nature. It's the first system that has an expansionary impetus built into it. And so what you see is that it starts local, it goes national, it goes global. It infiltrates every aspect of our lives from birth to death. It's a global system. It's a hegemonic system. It's a totality. And most people in the United States, even those that are people that claim to be radical, don't tend to see that. You saw that, for example, in the Sanders campaign. I used to think, well, there's not a lot of difference between Trump and Sanders in the sense of make America great again, America first. There are a lot of complicated issues we can get into, but it strikes me that a global system is one that requires a global response, and you don't see that much in the United States of that.
You point out that there have been no successful socialist revolutions in the rich capitalist nations, although there have been attempts, serious ones, right after World War I. Why have the successful revolutions been in the former colonial world and in the periphery of capitalism?
Well, I think one of the explanations for that is that if you look at the Global South, for example, this is where you see what you might call super exploitation of workers. I'm the editorial director of Monthly Review Press, and we published this book by a man from Great Britain, John Smith, called 21st Century Imperialism. And he points out that in the Global South, you have people that make a wage that's less than one that will allow a worker and his family to reproduce itself. In other words, they're living at below subsistence. And so you have tremendous amounts of profit being sucked out of the labor of people in the Global South, and it goes to the Global North. In fact, it helps to finance the states of the Global North, if you think about it, because the Global North is going to tax the corporations to some extent. It's going to tax rich people to some extent, and they're living from wealth that's created in the Global South. So the level of oppression in the Global South is extreme. And in a way, it's like what was true in the earliest phases of capitalism, where, as the great British historian E.P. Thompson points out, there's an assault upon an entire way of life by capital, and it's not graspable by people, and they revolt against it, like the Luddites who destroyed the machines, who demand they be treated as human beings. There are riots in the streets of Philadelphia in working-class neighborhoods because the new system strikes them like a hammer blow. Well, that's the way the tens of millions, the billions of workers in the Global South feel every day. And so they're more likely to feel that emotionally. Whereas in the rich capitalist countries, capital has become powerful through nationalism, for example, so that people come to think of themselves as Americans or British or French. And you can see that by creating the other, capital wins a tremendous victory. It can get working class people to kill themselves by the tens of millions in World Wars I, World War II, in all sorts of conflicts. So to some extent, that profit that's squeezed out of the Global South helps to buy off the working class in the Global North. The trouble is that that's come to an end pretty much. And the working class organizations that were successful in the Global North are under attack all over the place. And so you can see that the whatever victories workers have won, as I point out in chapter 4 of the book, I think, whatever they've won in the Global North, even in the most advanced countries in terms of working class standards of living, the Scandinavian countries, for example, are under sharp attack by capital. It's global. They move their enterprises. They threaten to move their enterprises to the Global South. So it's in the Global South where the oppression is the greatest, and it's in the Global South that you've seen successful revolutions in the Soviet Union, for example, in China, in Cuba, in Vietnam, and so on. In the Global North, the divides in the working class, the power of capital, the combination of the state and capital is so great that it's precluded any sort of anti-capitalist revolution so far.
Your book's an educational project. In fact, you begin with a definition of who is the working class. But as you point out, most unions in the United States don't have educational programs, much less radical educational programs.
Well, I'm probably a good person to talk to about that since I spent over 30 years as a labor educator. And what I discovered was is that that's true that unions in the United States, some of them have had in the past good education programs, and some still try to, like the United Electrical Workers, for example, a union that attempts to educate its workers from the get-go once they become union members and so on. But I had an interesting experience once that your listeners might be interested in. I was teaching workers in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, sort of quintessential industrial small city. Well, Bethlehem Steel was the dominant corporation. U.S. Steel had some things too, and there were miners and so on around there. So I'm teaching a group of workers, and some of them work at this air conditioning company in this small little town near Johnstown. And their union has made concessions to their employer mid-contract. They already had a collective bargaining agreement, and the bigwigs in the United Steelworkers Union decided to abrogate that contract and make concessions to the employers. Well, the students in my class, they taped every class. It was a class in collective bargaining. And they went back and they won an election to get new people elected to their local. And then they threatened strike and what have you, and they got back what the union had given away. And one of the things you find is that union leaders don't like education classes because what might happen? Their positions are challenged. And if you look at the way unions are structured in the United States, quite often they're structured just like the class enemy. They're structured just like corporations are. There's a great book by Greg Shotwell called Auto Workers Under the Gun. And the United Auto Workers has always been pointed to as a very progressive union. Supposedly progressive on issues of race, for example, supporting the civil rights struggles, which, of course, Walter Reuther, then president of the union, did. On the other hand, you have black workers revolting against the unions and the revolutionary union movements of the 1970s against the United Auto Workers. And it's a one-party state. You try to win power in that union as a dissident, and you're going to be in a lot of trouble. So unions fear education programs. There are some education programs that are associated with colleges. Now, I've taught in many of those. Penn State had one, Cornell had one, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, the University of Indiana. I taught in every one of those. And it was interesting, when I first went to taught at UMass Amherst, I was red-baited by the AFL-CIO. So there were some people who didn't want me to be in that program because they said I was a communist. Well, I managed to get in the program, and it worked out pretty well. But those programs are all under the gun. The universities attack them. They say they're not bringing in enough revenue, and the union support for those programs gets weaker and weaker. And so you're right. Labor education is an ongoing struggle in the United States, and there are good people that are involved in it, but not nearly enough. And the unions themselves don't have many education programs. Sure, they might train their shop stewards to file grievances and that sort of thing, but then workers don't learn anything about labor history. They don't learn anything about the capitalist economic system. Now, I tried to do that in my classes for 30 years, and it's interesting. I never met a worker, never, in any class that I ever taught, no matter where it was, from smoky union halls in Johnstown to college classrooms, where that labor theory of value of Marx, the notion that workers are exploited and their exploitation is the source of their employer's wealth, didn't resonate. It always does. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why isn't that happening more often? And maybe the answer is that look at Rich Trumka. What's he ever done? When's he ever made a statement on race, for example, in the United States, one of the fundamental divides within the working class? When's he ever organized mass strikes, mass protests, even against this government shutdown? The only thing you can say about Rich Trumka is he's never missed a meal since he's been head of the AFL-CIO. His pension keeps getting bigger and bigger, but less and less happens.
Well, that brings up something. You know, studies have shown which racial and ethnic groups in the United States are more or less favorable to unions. And they show that at the top, that is the group most favorable to unions, is black women, followed by black men, then in descending order, Hispanic women, followed by Hispanic men, and then going down the list, white women, and at the bottom, the least favorable to unions in the United States, the least favorable group is white men, and yet white men control most of the unions.
Doesn't that just speak for itself? I mean, it almost doesn't need any explanation, because if you look at the groups who are most favorable to unions, aren't those the people in the United States who are most like the workers in the Global South? In fact, as far as Hispanics go, they came from the Global South as immigrants. Of course, black people came to the United States as slaves, whose very bodies were owned by capital, in fact, and whose labors made the whole system possible when you get right down to it. There's been a whole new history building on the works of the great W.E.B. Du Bois, that capitalism has been racial from the get-go, so that black workers, Hispanic workers, women, black women, they face kind of a super exploitation like the workers in the Global South. So they're most attuned to the nature of the system, and they're most likely to see what's needed. Now, this is not to say that divides don't occur within those groups, too. I mean, that would be naive to think. And, of course, capital is quick to find, isn't it? It's quick to find the black woman who's a conservative, the black man who's a conservative, the Hispanic who's a conservative, and then trot them out on Fox News as if they represent the entire group of people, which is completely false. I wrote a book one time called Why Unions Matter, and I have a picture of this construction union, and every leader is a white man. The only unions that are dominated by women are like the nurses union, where most of the workers are women. There are a couple of unions where there are black men and women who are in positions of, you know, at the top of the union hierarchy, but there just aren't very many. So you could see the power of race there as a divider of the working class. And when you see that black people are oppressed and living in the most miserable conditions, then, of course, when you have a society that's structured racially, when people live their lives as whites, for example, then the fact that more black workers are in prison, that more black workers do crappy jobs, make lower wages, then that justifies what white workers think about them. And they say to themselves, well, look, they must be inferior because look at where they are, without seeing that the system is structured in such a way so that that happens. It's like one time a coworker of mine when I was a college teacher said that he must be more productive than me because his pay was higher.
Now, you write that you recognize that strictly class-based schemes will never close the gap in wages between blacks and whites, much less the huge gap in wealth. And if that is the case, then blacks, of course, could not be expected to join with people who insist on a class-only kind of politics.
Well, no, that's certainly true. And I my thinking on that has undergone some changes. You know, I used to be probably, you could say, when I was younger and I first learned about Marx and so on, I probably was more inclined to take a class first position. I remember with respect to, say, environmental struggles, the editor of Monthly Review magazine, or I'm associated with Monthly Review, John Foster, was one of the first people to really talk about degradation of the environment by capital. And I used to think, why so much focus on that? Why not focus on the working class? And of course, you begin to see that those struggles are obviously tied together. And the same thing's true with race and gender. Race has been an especially important factor in countries like the United States, but in lots of the global North. So that race has an independent effect on people in many, many ways, as every single study shows. You cannot do a study where you isolate the race of a person, the skin color of a person, where you can isolate that as a factor that determines a lot of other things. And there's not a single study that doesn't show that race in and of itself is an important determinant of wages. It's an important determinant of wealth. It's an important determinant of your success in the labor market, and so on and so forth. So I don't really see why scholars like, say, Adolf Reed can't see that race is something that has to be dealt with on its own as you wage the class struggle. That's the point. You know, people say, and a lot of radicals have said, well, that's divisive, that fighting within the working class over issues of race is divisive, that fighting over issues of gender is divisive, that fighting about the environment is divisive. Well, that just seems like a lot of nonsense to me. If you don't address those struggles inside of an organization, inside of every working class struggle, inside of Occupy Wall Street, inside of labor unions, inside of political organizations like the Democratic Socialists that have grown so rapidly in the United States, if you don't deal with issues of race inside of those organizations, then they're going to fester, and like you say, it's going to alienate the very people who are the strongest advocates of unions, of political struggle, of radical change. And it just seems like a dead-end strategy to me, and one doomed to failure, but it seems like a lot of people on the left, so to speak, in the United States, for example, just don't see that, and they continue to make the same kind of lame arguments over and over and over and over and over again. And you just see that, I mean, you could feel that that strategy is just not ever going to work. And let me give you an example of why. I taught a class one time to auto workers in Pittsburgh. They had a plant there that made parts for used cars. And it was very interesting. And one day, a white worker in the class made a rather disparaging remark about people that receive public assistance. And a black sister got up and challenged the person. And it was interesting because in that classroom, in that union structure, we could discuss that. We could deal with that. She stood up for herself. He was made to look foolish. And in the end, I think there was an increase in understanding. Well, I don't see what's wrong with that. That's what's necessary. You have to have those kinds of struggles inside your organization to build class solidarity. The racial divide in the United States sometimes seems just so overwhelming to me. I kind of lose hope in some ways. But then you'll see things around the world and give you some hope that those divides can be conquered. I mean, take a country like India, the class structure, the caste system. It's tied into skin color, it's tied into all kinds of things. It's like seems overwhelming to defeat it. And yet you see in these general strikes, there's some attempt to overcome that. So it's really the only hope for us, I think. The only hope is that, like I phrase it in the book this way, we have a system that's based upon the exploitation of wage labor, but we have a system of expropriation as well. And land has been expropriated from peasants. Bodies have been expropriated from black people through slavery and that. The labor of women in the households has been expropriated. And those are just as essential to the workings of the system as the exploitation. And unless you deal with those problems as a unified whole and you resist on every front all the time, then capital will always win.
That was author and labor educator Michael Yates.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, rallied in Philadelphia last week, demanding that the city's district attorney, Larry Krasner, do nothing to interfere with Abu-Jamal's chance to appeal his conviction in the death of a policeman 38 years ago. A long list of people took to the microphone, beginning with a high school classmate of Abu-Jamal, when Mumia was known as Wesley Cook.
My name is James E. Chisholm, Jr. I am a classmate of Brother Cook's from the class of 69 of Malcolm X High School. Brother Cook and myself were Kearney and Womack and a few others. We're the ones who got together and decided that we needed an African-American principal in a 95% black male high school. That's why Lowenstein was asked to leave and we got Brother Bass. We decided that we needed black department heads in the high school because it was 97% black. That's how we got the department heads. I was fortunate enough to be accepted into a predominantly black college at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina. I wasn't able to finish because the mayor here at that time cut the Model Cities grants, which everybody knows, and built that gallery, which was a failure. And a lot of people don't understand the reason why it was a failure, because a lot of our children knew that our grants to have us finish in the predominantly black colleges was taken away from us in our sophomore and junior year. But moving forward, because I followed this movement and I've been in, you know, Ben Franklin High School, which is what it was called. My diploma says Ben Franklin High School. All my awards say Malcolm X High School and signed by Brother Leon Bass. But I'm just saying, at 66 years old, you know, and being able to now being retired for 4 years, I've been down to the Justice Center. I held up a sign that said Malcolm X High School, class of 69, supports you, and it was never shown on the TV. But now God has blessed me with being able to be on the executive committee of the NAACP, and I was just elected the second most vote getter of 24 executive board members of the NAACP. And I'm here to tell you that my primary purpose was first to try to get elevators at Broad and Erie, because I don't understand why all these other corners have elevators, and we have a hospital, a community legal center, and all these veterans that come to Broad and Erie, and we should have had elevators there before they was at Market Street, 15th and Market. But now, since they didn't put up my sign, and I know they saw that, now when I am installed in January, my primary purpose is going to be to ask President Rodney Muhammad to institute an effort to include Free Mabia Jamal immediately once we are installed. And I'm going to do that because I remember him sitting across the table from me saying, Brother Chiz, we got to do this. Everybody thought that we couldn't close down that high school. It was Brother Dave Richardson, who was my mentor, who called the high school and said, listen, Rizzo getting ready to run up in there, chain the doors. We chained the doors. People said that Edison and Ben Franklin couldn't be in the same room together. We were in the gym together. People said that women could not be in the same gym together. We had William Penn, Gratz, and other high schools in that gym and closed it down until they removed Lowenstein and installed Bass. So I'm just saying, I think God has allowed me to be mothballed or morphed until this time, because I think if I had spoke out and been more vocal, I wouldn't be in the position that I am now. Because I'm going to push this forward. I've been in the political realm, but I think that I'm going to leave that to the young'uns. And I'm going to make sure that when I install, that this is the first primary purpose that we put forward in the Philadelphia NAACP.
What's your name?
Ann Lamb is going to speak to us about the larger fight to free political prisoners. Thank you.
Free them all. What's the call?
Free them all.
What's the call?
Free them all.
What's the call?
Free them all.
What's the call?
Free them all.
What's the call?
Free them all.
All right, that's the call. I'm really proud and honored to be here today. Thank you, Sister Johanna. I work with the Jericho Movement. We were formed back in 1998 for all U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war. Had the honor and the privilege to work with such people as Sister Safia Bukhari, who I'd like to do a presente for. Safia Bukhari, presente. Herman Ferguson, presente. I could go on and on with presentes because we have lost a lot of people inside those walls. And we all know that. And we have memories of many of them. And it is very sad, you know, that we were not able to build a large enough movement to pull people out of there before they had to die inside. And we certainly don't want Mumia to die inside, and we know his health is not good. So even though we're having a little celebration here, we also have to remember that the DA, the so-called progressive DA, Krasner, is likely going to appeal this decision. So even though we have been fighting against that and have people doing phone calls, emails, rallies, etc., keep spreading the word, people. People can still get in touch with DA Krasner. We need to keep it up. Keep the pressure on that DA. However we have to do it, you know, put a fire under him and make sure that he does not appeal. Because if he appeals, that will make all this take that much longer. And Mumia has cirrhosis of the liver. He has glaucoma. He's not well. He's 64 years old. Mumia is like one of our greatest, you know, political prisoners in terms of his speaking and his writing. And, you know, we're really happy to have him in the world. I happen to be wearing today a T-shirt with a quote from Bobby Sands. It's not just the Palestinians who support Mumia and our political prisoners. We got Irish political prisoners who support our political prisoners. We have, you know, people all over the world who support our political prisoners. We have Basque political prisoners who support our political prisoners. We have Turkish political prisoners who support our political prisoners. We have been doing international work for a long, long time. So I think it's past time not only for Mumia to come home, it's past time for everybody to come home. It's past time for Rochelle McGee to come home. He's been down since 1963. It's past time for Ed Poindexter, who is innocent and has just passed his 48th birthday inside the walls, to come home. It's time for Chip Fitzgerald to come home. It's time for Jahlil Muntakim to come home. It's time for Dr. Mutulu Shakur to come home. It's time for Marius Mason to come home. It's time for all these prisoners who have been locked down for so many years to come home. And the reason they've been locked down is because the U.S. government is afraid of their ideas. They're not afraid they're going to come out here and recidivate. They're afraid they're going to come out here and talk to people and educate people out here, just like they've all been doing inside. They have mentored thousands and thousands of young men and women. It is time for all the MOVE people to come home, way past time for the MOVE people to be home. You know, we got a lot of innocent people locked behind these walls, not just our political prisoners. I have met so many people inside that the political prisoners have told me, and this guy is wrongfully convicted, and this person over here is wrongfully convicted. Tomorrow I'm going to see Reverend Joy Powell. Reverend Joy Powell is wrongfully convicted. Reverend Joy Powell is an anti-police brutality activist from Rochester, New York, and was framed up. So, you know, in addition to taking care of and worrying about Mumia, we also have to worry about everybody else. And we can do it, and we know we can do it, because this year passed, we got 4 political prisoners out the door. That's we, the people. We, the people, exercised our power and our perseverance, and we pulled out 4 people, and we hope to pull out more. We got Herman Bell out the door, right? We got Robert Seth Hayes out the door, and he sends regards. Ann Jaffe just spoke to him very recently. He sends regards to everybody and also to Mumia. We got Debbie Africa out the door, which was fantastic. And we got Mike Africa, her husband, out the door, right? So I say, you know, it shows we can do it. If we have, you know, and like Johanna said, we have an intergenerational struggle. We have older people. We have younger people. We can all learn from each other. We all need to be united. We all need to work together, because the only way we're ever going to defeat this system is if we are united in one mighty fist. It is the only way. So what's the call? Free them all!
So my name is Megan Malachi, and I'm from Philly Real Justice. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about what it's like to grow up in Philly with the shadow of Mumia. So whenever I'm at these events, I think about the fact that I'm 37 and that Mumia has been incarcerated my entire life. I think about what it's like to grow up knowing about the Black Panthers who were stripped naked by Rizzo's cops, and having parents who grew up in West Philly and my dad coming home from college and being assaulted by Rizzo's cops. So when you're young growing up in Philly, you grow up in the shadow of all of that white supremacist Philadelphia history. So people have already talked about what it would mean for the movement if Mumia came home, but I think we also need to stress how much it would mean to the youth who are in the streets struggling if Mumia came home. All of the youth know about Meek Mill, but not enough of them know about Mumia. Mumia is the original political prisoner that most of the people my age know about. So I'm also a school teacher, and I'm trying to teach the youth about what Mumia means and what it means to be a Black Philadelphian growing up with that history of this city. Not only are we going to bring Mumia home, we're going to bring the rest of the MOVE 9 home. Not only are we going to bring Mumia home, but we're going to bring all political prisoners home. Because Mumia always talked about how every single person locked up is a political prisoner. And we can't pick and choose who we want to come home based on their so-called politics, because everyone who's locked up is a political prisoner because they are wrapped up in these white supremacist politics. And finally, we're also going to bring that Rizzo statue down. People have talked about how bringing the Rizzo statue down is simply a symbolic gesture. But I think that's an incomplete understanding of what Rizzo has meant to the people in this city. And also what it means to be a poor person in the city, to go and pay your water bill, to go and pay your housing taxes in a neighborhood that's being gentrified and have to walk past the Rizzo statue. So I'm in this moment right now as a relatively young person feeling so hopeful because I know that this city and all of us black and oppressed people have the capacity to do so much. So I want us all to stay in the streets. I want us to talk about MUMIA in our classrooms and in our homes because this is the most important movement I've seen in about 20 years. So on a move.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.